Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We live in the richest nation in the world, and we spend more on healthcare than any other country. Twice as much, in fact. But our health outcomes are far worse, and life expectancy here is lower than in other major Western countries. WFAE series The Price We Pay closely examines many different aspects of healthcare in America, and this edition looks at why working-class Americans have been dying at higher rates from drugs, alcohol, suicide, and cardiovascular disease from obesity than those in more affluent urban areas. Part of the answer is connected to education. This hour, we are reviewing our conversation from August of this year when we were joined by Kathleen Mullen-Harris, a distinguished professor of sociology and adjunct professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Dr. Mark Holmes, professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of North Carolina School of Global Public Health, and director of the Cecil Shepp Center for Health Services Research, where he is also the director of the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center. And Dr. Jerome Williams joined us. He is the medical doctor on our panel, and he specializes in cardiovascular disease and interventional cardiology, where he is also senior vice president of consumer engagement. Throughout our series, The Price We Pay, we've been looking at how life expectancy can decline depending on where you live because of income stresses and the stress brought on by unstable neighborhoods and unstable homes and inadequate access to food, etc. In this installment of The Price We Pay, it turns out Americans are dying younger than people in other wealthy countries by about 3.5 years on average, and the gap is only growing. Much of this is being fueled by, as I mentioned, higher rates of death from suicide, drugs, alcohol, cardiovascular disease. We're going to talk about all these factors during this conversation, but I begin the discussion by asking Dr. Mark Holmes if there was a relationship between education and the longevity of working-age Americans.
Well, absolutely. I think, and you know, Dr. Harris can get into this in more detail, I'm sure, since she's one of the world's experts on this. But the notion of education as an important driver of life expectancy is critical. I mean, we know that, you know, decades of research have shown that the more education you get in general, the better your health behaviors. You're less likely to smoke, for example. The better outcomes you have in terms of morbidity and mortality. You know, you're doing different kinds of jobs as an occupation, so your the physical wear on your body isn't as great as it is in other sources. We can get into stagnation of office desk jobs in a moment, I suppose, at some point to talk about that. But I think, you know, this is a really critical factor, and we've seen it even today. When you look at vaccination rates for COVID-19, there's a huge educational gradient across counties where with a pretty high degree of predictability, the more educated the county, the higher the rate of COVID vaccinations. And we know that's an important driver of health and will continue to be, as this pandemic continues.
Dr. Harris, as we think about this and as we go through this program and we talk about education and its intersection with healthcare, it seems to me that perhaps that is the common denominator of this week's program and last week's program, because if you're not highly educated, the chances are you're going to be economically stressed for much of your life. Is this like a Venn diagram where this is education is the big thing in the intersecting circles?
Education seems to be a really important driver of the disparity in morbidity and now these rising mortality rates that we see for drug overdose, suicide, and cardiometabolic diseases. But it's related, the mechanisms that are operating are complex. Many of them are structural. They, you know, operate upstream to, you know, actual individual behavior and healthcare and the emergence of disease that have to do with opportunities, you know, educational opportunities, depending on where you live, what your family income levels are, and you know, issues related to the communities and your social networks. So it's complex, and it's just important to understand that. You know, that many of the structural sorts of factors related to inequality and policy and changes in technology play a role here.
And Dr. Williams, we're going to talk a lot about cardiovascular disease and the epidemic of obesity in America, but obesity and the cardiovascular problems that follow as a result are not limited to people who have economic stresses. You don't have to be poor to be obese. Talk about how education plays a role in what your profession is seeing, the cardiovascular disease as a result of being overweight.
So once again, thanks for having me, Mike. You know, when we look at clinical disease states, chronic medical conditions, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, lung disease, et cetera, we recognize, we realize, and we understand now, or I should say the lay public understands now that 80 to 90% of chronic medical problems have absolutely nothing to do with biology and genetics, but all to do with the environment and behaviors that folks engage in. So the term that we use now is social determinants of health. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, we called it community health and social medicine. But the concept is very simple. While as Dr. Harris outlined, it's a very complex interplay of a lot of interdependencies, but the concept is very simple, which is that your health is significantly impacted by the environment that you live or you don't live in, and the behaviors that you engage in. And some of those behaviors and some of those environmental factors are dictated by structures, dictated by rules and regulations and policies, historical rules and regulations that affect certain communities more than others. So when we talk specifics, we're talking about housing insecurities, food insecurities, lack of upward mobility, which is the topic of this conversation today. And with those challenges in the social determinants of health, your choices are either limited, such as healthy food choices, right? So if you live in a food desert, the likelihood that you have access to nutritious, healthy food is a lot less, which increases your rates of obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and then subsequent heart disease. So it really is about the social determinants of health that we have to now find solutions for, and not just medical, biologic, and genetic solutions that we have within the four walls of a hospital or four walls of a clinic.
A lot of the problems we're going to talk about affect people in urban areas as well as rural areas. But Mark Holmes, you're the director of the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center. And a lot of the things that we talked about at the very beginning, suicide, alcohol and drug abuse and addiction problems like that, are the result of what some people call deaths. The deaths from these things are called deaths of despair. And we've gone through a long period in this country and around the world, actually, in which working class people lost jobs that had been handed down from generation to generation. Some people worked, their grandparents worked in the factory that they were working in, and those jobs simply disappeared. How big a problem, how big a contributing factor to what we're talking about today is that here in North Carolina and around the country?
Well, if we look nationally, we know that manufacturing jobs are a higher percent of employment in rural counties than they are in urban. And I think, you know, sometimes we still think of rural counties as being farming and mining and forestry dependent, but manufacturing has been critical there for, you know, for a long time. If you look at what's happened in the last two decades, roughly, we've seen about a 30% decline nationwide in manufacturing jobs. And so if you think about how that is affecting rural counties, as you mentioned, Mike, and rural communities, these are often some of the better jobs in these settings. And you're seeing this erosion of economic opportunity particularly for those that don't traditionally require a post high school education. And so this is a real pointy end of the spear, so to speak, as we're seeing this, rural communities have depended on manufacturing or have really benefited from strong manufacturing component, and it's been eroded, and it's been hitting exactly this demographic that we've been talking about, working age with, maybe some college education, but, generally not college graduates.
Dr. Harris, you have said that it's hard to measure despair. Two Princeton professors wrote a book about this, and they say that the underlying cause is that U.S. capitalism and democracy stopped working for those without college degrees. Are they on the right track, in your opinion?
I think so. I hate to give the answer. It's more complex. The issue of despair. So I chaired a committee at the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, Medicine that took on a consensus study to examine, what were the causes of rising mortality, among whom, and what are the disparities. So the Princeton economists Ann Case and Angus Deaton had really been the ones to, set the alarm off about rising midlife mortality. They primarily focused on ages 45 to 54 and showed that mortality was rising here due to drug overdose, suicide, and alcohol, liver disease, basically. At that point, they're the ones that sort of coined this phrase, the diseases of despair. Now, in our academy's report, we obviously, tried to understand, what were the causes of these rises in mortality. And so the reason, our conclusion is that it's difficult to really measure despair. We don't have any standardized, validated measures of what despair is, in the sense that we have, valid diagnoses of depression and anxiety and other sort of issues, especially related to mental health and emotional health. So that's where that's coming from. There are proxies, of course, for despair, measures of sort of hopelessness, sadness, or worry. And these seem to be connected to substance use, for sure. And of course, suicide. It's just difficult to draw causal associations. And, and Dr. Case and Dr. Deaton would certainly, agree with that. They had input into our study. Whether or not there is just the one thing that we did conclude in our report is that there is not one underlying cause. So there is not, we can't say despair causes all of this. The evidence is just not there. The patterns of these trends in mortality are all different and are not related to one cause. So that's sort of what we concluded.
That's Dr. Kathleen Harris from UNC Chapel Hill. We will continue our conversation on the decrease in life expectancy in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the declining longevity of working-class Americans, which has been pointed out in several studies, and the rising incidence of alcohol-related problems, drug-related problems, obesity, and cardiovascular disease, etc. with Dr. Kathleen Harris, the Distinguished Professor of Sociology at UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Mark Holmes, Professor in the Department of Health Policy at UNC Chapel Hill, and Dr. Jerome Williams, Senior VP of Novant Health and a cardiologist there as well. You wanted to follow up, Dr. Holmes, on something that Kathleen Harris was saying just a moment ago by mentioning an auto assembly plant study that looked at some of the same things that she was just talking about.
Yeah, and thanks, Mike. I think Dr. Harris raises the key point that we don't really, you know, we see sort of what's happening in the community in terms of unemployment and income and opportunity, and we see the outcomes, mortality usually, but it's hard to know exactly how we get from one end of the, from these economic anxiety or drivers to the outcomes. And, you know, she's absolutely right that we don't, that our measures of despair and hopelessness and social connectedness are hard to develop on a population basis, which is exactly the kind of thing we're looking at here. But there have been some studies that really present evidence that is entirely consistent with this. You know, I think one example is a study a year or so ago that looked at auto assembly plant closures. Looking at about 29 different counties that, you know, experienced a large manufacturing closure, and then looked at what happened to opioid overdose rates in those counties after the closure. And sure enough, mortality from opioid overdose went up more in those counties than they did in counties that look a lot like it, but just didn't have a closure. So that's very consistent with this despair kind of hypothesis.
Go ahead, Williams. Dr. Williams.
I was going to say, I would also add that and by no stretch of the imagination, I would defer to Dr. Holmes and Dr. Harris as this is their field of expertise. However, if you look historically over the last few decades, what you see occurring in kind of rural America, white America, are trends that really were present in urban America and people of color for decades. And interestingly, if you look at the challenges, it's the similar challenges, right? So lack of upward mobility, lack of education, lack of access and opportunity that led to significant morbidity and mortality differences in communities of color versus white communities. Now you fast forward to the current day, or say when I current day last 10, 15, 20 years or so, where you see a number of jobs that historically have supported rural America, white America, they're now gone, right? And so with those lack of opportunities, access, et cetera, now you have the behaviors of drug use, drug overdose, et cetera, creeping in into the data sets. And you'll see very similar patterns that you noticed decades ago in historically communities of color. So, you know, the trends are there. You know, the trends are there. It's just a different cohort.
And Dr. Williams, the intersection of cardiovascular disease and obesity to all of this. I mean, we've talked about food deserts on this program and how difficult it is for some communities to get fresh, wholesome food because they don't live near a grocery store. And the stuff that they sell at convenience stores is highly processed and not good for you. And people have made a diet off of that, and that's leading to cardiovascular problems and obesity. Is the same true in these rural communities where if you lose your job and there are no job opportunities, you can't afford to buy food? And the stresses of all of that maybe cause you to binge eat on drug food, on junk food? Is that part of the problem here?
I think it parallels. Yes, I think it does definitely parallel. And it's not just unhealthy eating, but also unhealthy behaviors, right? Smoking, right? Increased access to alcohol, or increased use, I should say, of alcohol. The access is probably the same, but increased use of alcohol to, quote, treat some of the challenges and stressors that that the current situation is in front of folks right now.
One of the things that Ann Case points out in the book that we've already talked about here, Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, is that men's wages have stagnated for the past 50 years. Good jobs and benefits are disappearing because companies are now outsourcing less skilled work. And she says, because healthcare in America has been pinned to employment at a cost far greater than other wealthy countries, that has led companies to shed jobs and to keep wages low for those who remain so that they can pay for their employees' health coverage. If she's right about this, Dr. Holmes, how long have we known about this? And if we've known about this for a decent amount of time, why aren't companies behind some sort of universal health care to get those charges off their books?
Well, I'm an economist, not a political scientist, so I'm not going to get into that very
well. As an economist, wouldn't that make sense?
Well, I think, I mean, you raise a key point there, Mike, in that, you know, we are a healthcare system that is dominated in terms of insurance, at least for working age people, which is what we're talking about today, on the employer-sponsored insurance system. Most of us get our health insurance through our job. That's, you know, still roughly 60%, roughly. So and that's led to a couple of things. And so you've sort of dealt with one end of that, and that is that it increases as healthcare costs continue to increase. That's a cost that employers have to bear. And to some extent, they're trying to push them on employees to help share, and they've developed new products so that employees have skin in the game and lots of, you know, new sort of insurance designs. But the other side of that, of course, is that if I lose my job, I often am losing my health insurance. And so as we've been talking for the last 20-ish minutes about the decline of job opportunities in, again, I'm coming with a rural lens, and I appreciate Dr. Williams' comments that we need to think about the entire country. But as those jobs disappear, that means your insurance is disappearing. And so we've seen that as well in rural areas, that there's a roughly 7 percentage point difference in terms of the what kind of health insurance you're covered by, whether it's employer sponsored or something else. And that gap is picking up by either public insurance often, Medicaid, Medicare, which pays less and creates challenges and burdens on the healthcare providers operating in those communities. Maybe it's on what we call non-group insurance, or the kinds of insurance you get as a one person, Obamacare is often how this is referred to in the lay public, which often again will have a $5,000 deductible, which hospitals may not be able to get. Or the third bucket is just going uninsured, which again places a burden on the providers. And so as these jobs are declining and people, not just rural, but nationwide, are losing their job-based health insurance, that leads to a spiral. You know, the people can't pay for what they need. They're avoiding the simple ouch in the elbow that turns out, you know, 5 years later or 2 years later, you find out is bone cancer and it's incurable at that point. And it's placing financial burdens on the people. So to echo Dr. Harris, it's a very complex issue that has ramifications far beyond what we're thinking of.
These working class jobs did not wake up Dr. Harris one morning and suddenly discover all these jobs had disappeared. This has been a steady trickle, a steady decline over a long period of time. And many of these jobs didn't require much more than an 8th grade or 9th grade or 10th grade education. And now the new jobs that are coming along require bachelor's degrees or at least an associate's degree to get an income level that you can pay the bills on. So we saw this coming. I'm just curious, did people not see the need to go back and get further education? Did the education system fail us and not encourage more young people to finish high school and go to college, or at least a community college? Did we not tell them what would happen if they didn't?
Yeah, it's a good question. This trend, the economic transformation of industries and job opportunities has been going on since the 70s. And men's wages lost, started to lose traction. And I think, you know, what happened is when manufacturing, you know, first it left the cities and went, you know, out to the rural areas. And so that shifted, that meant, you know, people in urban areas who were working in manufacturing jobs started working in more service sector types of jobs, still low paying. But then when manufacturing, you know, sort of went overseas and mining industry went away, That's really what you know began this sort of very long-term sort of economic decline for especially those with less than a college education. And you know, I think that you know there why we didn't recognize it, or you know, families in rural areas said you have to get a college education. You know, it's tough if you live in an environment, as Dr. Williams was talking about, in a community where the education system isn't very strong. That's going to be, you know, put you at a disadvantage in terms of getting into college. Many young people, you know, might go to community college or get an associate's degree. We find actually that those who go on to college but don't finish are just as disadvantaged as those that say stop at high school. They could have, you know, substantial college debt at that point, and they can't seem to. So it's really that college education that seems to really be the marking line. So I think that, you know, with, I'll just end with, you know, that this pattern has been ongoing. The despair notion is really linked to this economic transformation that's been occurring to those with less than a college education. And I think when the Great Recession hit, that put certain segments of the population even further behind.
Dr. Harris, you led the study for the National Academy of Sciences into the country's rising mortality rates, which uncovered the fact that there are these three categories of causes of death and as the predominant drivers, which are, as we've said, drug poisoning and alcohol-induced causes, suicide, and cardiometabolic diseases. And you also found that it's not just older people who are succumbing to these things. It is younger people, sometimes in the prime of their lives, who do not have college degrees. And the problem is worse in rural areas. Would it be safe to say that the problem, because we have less life expectancy in this country than elsewhere, that the problem is worse in America than it is in any other Western industrialized nation?
Absolutely.
Why?
If I knew the answer, I'd be president or something.
But you don't want that.
Yeah, definitely. So we are, you know, we rank at the bottom among rich nations in terms of life expectancy. I think most people would point to one difference in America is high levels of inequality, which is what we've been talking about for the last hour. And, you know, the fact that there are just these very stark different opportunities for mobility, beginning with education and jobs. Much of that, you know, is disparities due to education and income, but also we have, you know, a legacy of race and ethnic inequality in America. Although that does not explain the lower life expectancy in the US, it's really the broader inequality. One of the things I'm glad that you brought up, because I want to emphasize how one of the more important findings is that it was young adults who seem to be experiencing some of the worsening trends. Their rates of mortality due to drug overdose, due to suicide, and due to hypertension and diabetes related to obesity have all increased more rapidly than older adults. Older adults being, you know, over age 45. The reason for that, I mean, I think for the obesity trend, it has to do with the fact that this is a cohort of young people who were born and have spent their entire lives in during the obesity epidemic and have been exposed to obesogenic environments that Dr. Williams was talking about.
Dr. Williams, when I was a young person in grade school, occasionally you would run across a peer who was referred to as husky, a little overweight, perhaps hadn't shed their baby fat, but most people were relatively skinny, to put it mildly. We have young people today who are grossly overweight. They're obese, and that leads to cardiovascular problems early in life, it seems to me. Not all of this can be connected to despair or lack of jobs or undereducation, can it?
Oh, I believe so. First of all, okay. I was one of those husky kids in high school, so that's why I snickered. I do believe it's all tied together. I, you know, At Novant, on our community engagement team, we have a concept where we engage with communities and we say we inform, we engage, and we activate. And those three kind of pillars are important because one, lack of education, the informing piece, a lack of education. Education can be a lot, right? It's not just about nutrition. But when people are concerned about whether or not they can pay their rent or they have a roof over their heads, whether or not they have a place to sleep at night, they're really not concerned about, well, did I get fresh kale or did I get, you know, spinach? I mean, that's just not in the thought process. And then if you are thinking about that, the question is, where do you have access to those types of food? So I do feel it's all interconnected. And then the behaviors, as I mentioned earlier, smoking, alcohol, et cetera, are those behaviors that are engaged in when one experiences hopelessness, right? When there is this thought that there's no upside. I do want to mention a point that Dr. Harris and Dr. Holmes mentioned early, and it had to do with insurance and health insurance and coverage. And we have to think about health insurance and coverage. If we go back to the 40s and 50s, when, you know, wages were stagnant, and so employers offered benefits, and some of those benefits included health care, but it wasn't universally applied across to all professions, right? So typically they were businesses, white collar type of workers. They were not agricultural workers, extended health insurance, and they were not service workers, right? So getting out of the gate, you have a disparity or an inequality in access to healthcare way back in the 40s and 50s, based on certain sectors of the economy. So I would argue that, you know, a lot of this is, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally, it was policy driven, okay, that had certain consequences that we are now dealing with right now. And we have to really face the policies, rules, and regulations that kind of dictate some of these outcomes.
Dr. Jerome Williams is the Senior Vice President of Novant Health for, I think, Public Affairs, and he is also a cardiologist there. Mark Holmes is at UNC Chapel Hill, as is Dr. Kathleen Harris. We'll continue our conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about longevity of working class Americans. In fact, it's declining, and I misspoke a minute ago. Dr. Jerome Williams is Senior Vice President of Consumer Engagement at Novant Health and a cardiologist. They call blood pressure, high blood pressure, the silent killer, because you don't, there are very few symptoms of it, and sometimes if you don't get your blood pressure checked by a doctor on a regular basis, it creeps up on you. Other impacts of that creep up on you. Is that part of the problem? Not just with obesity, but with the rise in cardiovascular disease, Dr. Williams, the fact that we don't have people who can afford health care in America.
Yeah, that is absolutely crucial. So high blood pressure, the silent killer, as you appropriately mentioned, often is very treatable if you have access to health care, if you have access to a primary care physician or a patient-centered medical home. Now, some of it is nutrition, some of it is just innate. Some folks actually do have high blood pressure who are thin, who exercise, who are, you know, completely healthy. But that's where access to care comes in, whether you have insurance access or there are individuals who have insurance but no access to healthcare in their communities, or they have to have significant distances to get to the healthcare. So access is a big point of in one of the social determinants of health as well.
Dr. Harris, you report that beginning in 2010, progress in life expectancy stalled in the United States, and then between 2014 and 2017, life expectancy fell for 3 years in a row. And as it did, you say, we began losing more and more Americans in the prime of their lives, in their most productive years, in their parenting years. What happened in 2010? What happened between 2014 and 2017 to make that happen?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because, you know, that was something that came out of the report and allowed us to really focus on that. After 2010, things really started to go worse. Two things, I think. You know, first of all, the aftermath of the recession occurred in such a way that in the past, after recessions, everybody sort of recovered in an equal way. So we always have a hierarchy, of course, in America, but, you know, the recover, you know, seemed to be equal across that hierarchy. But after the Great Recession, that didn't seem to occur. You know, those at the very top of the socioeconomic ladder in America recovered, you know, well, maybe better, where those at the bottom did not. That was one explanation. The other is the obesity epidemic that Dr. Williams has been talking about. And that is that, you know, that the obesity epidemic began in the early 1980s, and obesity rates have not really declined much. They've started to level off, but, you know, 30 years after our population has been exposed to obesity and obesogenic environments, the health consequences, the cardiometabolic health consequences of hypertension, as you just mentioned, diabetes, heart disease, we're starting to kick in. And you definitely see that among the young adults who have surprisingly high rates of things like diabetes. You know, we have a study of adolescents we've been following for 25 years, and by midlife, more than half of them are obese and have hypertension. So that's what we think, it's really the lagged consequences of the exposure to obesity.
I want to talk about this obesity epidemic that began in the 80s in a second, but Mark Holmes, you reviewed a recent study that reveals that more people die from chronic health conditions and substance abuse in rural America than in suburbs and cities, and that the gap, in fact, is widening. Is that strictly because of a lack of employment opportunities in rural areas, or are there other factors involved in that?
Well, I would point to other factors as well. We've talked about the health insurance component and this access that Dr. Williams mentioned. And that's everything from what kind of health insurance I have to how do I get to the doctor? If I don't have a car, am I relying on the transit system? And if you live in rural North Carolina, there are great systems that, you know, and rural transit that will take you to the hospital that's, you know, two counties away. But the van leaves at 6:30 in the morning and it comes back at 5:30 at night. So now you're losing a whole day's work. And then you have to sit there and say, well, you know, it's been bothering me for a couple of weeks, but I could probably put it off a little bit longer. And that's exactly the access issue that Dr. Williams mentioned as well. Coupled on top of that, sorry, Mike, but just rural hospital closures. And I think we've seen a decline in the number of what we call providers, but hospitals, clinics, physicians, you name it, the kinds of things that we go to get our health care, everything from hospitals to throw dentists in there as well. But those are declining and far fewer in rural areas, which is an additional challenge to keep to staying healthy.
And there's a team member of the study that you looked at. I think it's Dr. Herder Warwick. I think that's how you say his name. That's close, at least, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and with the VA Boston healthcare system, who believes that much of the problem that we're witnessing right now in rural communities is likely to spread to urban and suburban areas. Why would that be?
Well, I'm still thinking about something Dr. Williams said at like 9:10, which was this notion of this economic opportunity decline, which was widely prevalent, or at least, you know, certainly not uncommon in communities of color in urban areas. Now it's affecting rural white, particularly without college education, we're paying a lot of attention to it when it's rural white people, I think, is one way to sort of interpret, I think, the interest in the last 15 years. You know, is this a trend that's going to continue to affect more populations, or is this something that we are going to address head on and try and figure out where these, how to bring opportunity back to all of our communities? And I certainly hope it's the latter. But I mean, I think Hyder's pessimism and what's coming probably is reasonable, that if we're seeing an expansion of these challenges, who's to say that, what are we doing to make that, to keep those opportunities from not declining further?
Let's talk to Dr.
Mike. If I could just quickly follow up on what Dr. Holmes commented on, one of the important findings that we had is that while this pattern of rising mortality occurred first among whites, especially less educated whites, what we found in the recent years is we're seeing the same increases in mortality rates due to suicide and drug overdose among Blacks and Hispanics. So we think that trend is coming. The rural versus urban disparities still exist, but we're seeing that this loss of life expectancy is spreading to almost all population segments in the United States.
Some of that is not very visible, which is what makes these studies that you conduct so valuable, because it uncovers things that to the naked eye, to the average person, are not visible. One thing that is visible, Dr. Williams, is obesity. And as one of the other guests mentioned a second ago, the obesity epidemic started in the 1980s, and we have become, in those years since then, we have the dubious distinction of being the most obese of the world's wealthy nations. Why? Do we know why that happened?
I think it's a combination of the food source that we have. I think it's we have a very highly processed system, food chain. That term high fructose corn syrup that's in everything, I think ravaged our youth in the 80s and 90s in terms of adding calories and obesity. I think that the pattern of eating on the go, eating takeout food, all of that contributed to it. I also think there's a role of lack of activity, exercise, and engagement outdoors due to increasing use of technology, iPhones, iPads, and those types of things that engage our youth as opposed to historically, going outside and playing. So I think all of those contribute to obesity, the obesity epidemic, and we're now seeing the consequences of that.
And if I could just jump on that as well. And I think those are great points. I want to extend the behavior question and bring it back to opportunity again. I have a greenway a half mile from me. I have sidewalks. I have streetlights. And when it's raining, I can go to the elliptical I have in my own house. How many people with lower income don't have those same opportunities? Growing up in a rural area, my option was to walk along the side of a 55 mile an hour two-lane road with no shoulder. And always remember, on the curves especially, to sort of be looking ahead. So, the notion of vast differences in opportunity and access to physical activity, I think, is another point I would add on as well.
Dr. Williams, health officials have identified several zip codes within Charlotte as being food deserts, 28205, 28206, 28208, et cetera, et cetera. These are, generally speaking, lower income, Black, and underserved neighborhoods, in some cases undereducated neighborhoods, where people living there are not close to a grocery store. Are the instances of cardiovascular disease coming from those areas higher than they are in other areas in Charlotte?
So a couple of things. It's an interesting question depending on which data sets you look at, right? And I'll explain that in a second. When you talk about those zip codes, and we all acknowledge that's called the Crescent, right? There's a history of segregation, there's a history of poverty, and then you have all those other challenges that you speak of, including increased death of COVID rates and things of that nature. I said it depends on which data set you look at, because I was looking at some data yesterday from a cardiovascular vendor that showed we were looking at disparities in care as it relates to certain cardiovascular disease states, atrial fibrillation, heart failure, things of that nature. And it was interesting because in the Crescent, they showed low disparate outcomes in those particular areas. And the reason is, as we continued our discussion yesterday, the reason has to do with the fact that they're not measuring people who don't touch the system, right? So if you don't touch a clinic, if you don't touch a hospital, you're not being measured. So when we do our community health needs assessment, which is an assessment that we do as a not-for-profit hospital system in conjunction with the county, when we do our community health needs assessment, we identify needs throughout the community. And yes, within those zip codes, within the Crescent, there's a high degree of not just cardiovascular disease, but stroke, as well as other medical problems all throughout those zip codes. And so it's definitely associated with lack of social determinants of health opportunities, poverty, segregation, et cetera.
The stressors that come with having a low income we talked about them last week. They're numerous. And part of the problem is that people in America can work a minimum wage job 40 hours a week and not make enough money to live well, to feed themselves, to house themselves well. And I would think this is the same situation in rural areas as well. Mark Holmes, is that accurate?
Well, sure. And then above that, Mike, you might be, rather than working 40 hours at a minimum, you might have two jobs working 20. And now you don't have health insurance and you're making too much to qualify for a lot of public assistance. So we have a system that makes it really expensive to be poor.
And it makes it expensive for society at large, does it not? Because we are picking up the cost of this. Would it be cheaper for us to provide through taxation some sort of universal health care versus picking up the tab of unpaid hospital bills for people who can't afford to pay them and who are uninsured and who have more underlying medical problems because they can't see a doctor, because they can't afford to, and because they can't eat the proper foods because they don't have access to those foods because they live in low-income areas that grocery stores won't go to. This is all entangled like a mess. But yeah. Would the cost be lower ultimately if we did what other Western nations did?
So what Dollars to Donuts, one of the reports that Dr. Williams looks at regularly are preventable admissions and what's usually called inappropriate emergency department use. So these are people who show up to the ED because they have some tooth that's just been abscessed that they've been ignoring because they can't afford to pay $200 to go to the dentist. So they end up in an ED where it costs thousands of dollars to deal with. And it's so much far progressed than if we had dealt with it 6 months ago, could have dealt with. And apply that to lots of other diabetes, complications, et cetera. You know, it turns out that, yeah, if you deal with it up front, it's far cheaper. And the system's often paying for that. And by the system, that's everyone on this call and everyone on your audience who's hearing that.
Dr. Harris, I have about 30 seconds left. Your study examining the deaths from despair, you came up with some strategies to maybe alleviate some of these problems. Can you share just a few of them with us? Because we only have about 30 seconds.
Some of the recommendations that we made were first, consistent with what Dr. Holmes is saying. We recommend that the 12 states that have not expanded Medicaid do so. In terms of the obesity epidemic and the cardiometabolic diseases, we really argue we need to start young, that, you know, once someone is obese, it's very, treatments aren't always that successful. They're very expensive. So prevention is really paramount. Those are the two main ones.
Dr. Kathleen Harris is the James E. Hart Distinguished Professor of Sociology at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Mark Holmes, Professor in the Department of Health Policy at UNC Chapel Hill, School of Global Public Health, and Director of the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center. And Dr. Jerome Williams is a cardiologist and Senior Vice President at Novant Health. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.